Even when they are, the numbers would be greatly against us. The common longship is small compared to our galleys, this is true, but the Iron Men have larger ships as well. Lord Balon's great Kraken and the warships of the Iron Fleet were made for battle, not for raids. They are the equal of our lesser war galleys in speed and strength, and most are better crewed and captained. The Iron Men live their whole lives at sea. Robert should have scoured the isles after Balon Greyjoy rose against him, Circe thought. He smashed their fleet, burned their towns, and broke their castles, but when he had them on their knees, he let them get up again. He should have made another island of their skulls. That was what her father would have done. But Robert never had the stomach that a king requires if he hopes to keep peace in the realm. The Iron Men have not dared raid the Reach since Dagon Greyjoy sat the sea stone chair, she said. Why would they do so now? What has emboldened them? Their new king. Kyburn stood with his hands hidden up his sleeves. Lord Balon's brother. The Crow's Eye, he is called. Carrion crows make their feasts upon the carcasses of the dead and dying, said Grand Maester Pycelle. They do not descend upon hale and healthy animals. Lord Euron will gorge himself on gold and plunder, aye, but as soon as we move against him, he will back to pike, as Lord Dagon was wont to do in his day. You are wrong, said Marjorie Tyrell. Reavers do not come in such strength. 1,000 ships? Lord Hewitt and Lord Chester are slain, as well as Lord Surrey's son and heir. Surrey has fled to Highgarden, with what few ships remain him, and Lord Grimm is a prisoner in his own castle. Willis says that the Iron King has raised up 4 lords of his own in their places. Willis, Circe thought, the cripple. He is to blame for this. That oaf, Mace Tyrell, left the defence of the Reach in the hands of a hapless weakling. It is a long voyage from the Iron Isles to the Shields, she pointed out. How could 1,000 ships come all that way without being seen? Willis believes that they did not follow the coast, said Marjorie. They made the voyage out of sight of land, sailing far out into the Sunset Sea and swooping back in from the west. More like the cripple did not have his watchtowers manned, and now he fears to have us know it. The little queen is making excuses for her brother. Circe's mouth was dry. I need a cup of Arbor Gold. If the Iron Men decided to take the Arbor next, the whole realm might soon be going thirsty. Stannis may have had a hand in this. Balon Greyjoy offered my lord father an alliance. Perhaps his son has offered one to Stannis. Pycelle frowned. What would Lord Stannis gain by? He gains another foothold. And plunder, that as well. Stannis needs gold to pay his sellswords. By raiding in the west, he hopes he can distract us from Dragonstone and Storm's End. Lord Merryweather nodded. A diversion. Stannis is more cunning than we knew. Your Grace is clever to have seen through his ploy. Lord Stannis is striving to win the Northmen to his cause, said Pycelle. If he befriends the Ironborn, he cannot hope. The Northmen will not have him, said Circe, wondering how such a learned man could be so stupid. Lord Manderly hacked the head and hands off the Onion Knight. We have that from the phrase, and 6 other northern lords have rallied to Lord Bolton. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Where else can Stannis turn but to the Iron Men and the Wildlings, the enemies of the North? But if he thinks that I am going to walk into his trap, he is a bigger fool than you. She turned back to the little queen. The Shield Islands belong to the Reach. Grimm and Ceri and the rest are sworn to Highgarden. It is for Highgarden to answer this. Highgarden shall answer, said Marjorie Tyrell. Willis has sent word to Leighton Hightower in Old Town, so he can see to his own defences. Garlon is gathering men to retake the Isles. The best part of our power remains with my lord father, though. We must send word to him at Storm's End at once. And lift the siege? Circe did not care for Marjorie's presumption. She says at once to me, does she take me for her handmaid? I have no doubt that Lord Stannis would be pleased by that. Have you been listening, my lady? If he can draw our eyes away from Dragonstone and Storm's End to these rocks. Rocks, gasped Marjorie. "Did your grace say rocks?" The Knight of Flowers put a hand upon his sister's shoulder. "If it please your grace, from those rocks the Iron Men threaten Old Town and the Arbor. From strongholds on the shields, raiders can sail up the Mander into the very heart of the Reach, as they did of old. With enough men they might even threaten Highgarden." "Truly?" said the Queen, all innocence. "Why then your brave brother had best roust them off those rocks, and quickly." "How would the Queen suggest they accomplish that without sufficient ships?" asked Sir Loras. "Willis and Garland can raise 10,000 men within a fortnight, and twice that in a moon's turn, but they cannot walk on water, your grace."
"Highgarden sits above the Mander," Circe reminded him. "You and your vassals command 1,000 leagues of coast. Are there no fisher folk along your shores? Do you have no pleasure barges, no ferries, no river galleys, no skiffs?"
"Many and more," Sir Loras admitted.
"Such should be more than sufficient to carry a host across a little stretch of water, I would think."
"And when the longships of the Ironborn descend upon our ragtag fleet, as it's making its way across this little stretch of water, what would your grace have us do then?"
"Drown," thought Circe.
"Highgarden has gold as well. You have my leave to hire sell sails from beyond the narrow sea."
"Pirates, out of mere and lice, you mean," Loras said with contempt. "The scum of the free cities."
"He is as insolent as his sister. Sad to say, all of us must deal with scum from time to time," she said, with poisonous sweetness. "Perhaps you have a better notion."
"Only the Arbor has sufficient galleys to retake the mouth of the Mander from the Iron Men and protect my brothers from their longships during their crossing. I beg your grace, send word to Dragonstone and command Lord Redwine to raise his sails at once."
"At least he has the sense to beg." Paxter Redwine owned 200 warships and 5 times as many merchant carracks, wine cogs, trading galleys, and whalers. Redwine was encamped beneath the walls of Dragonstone, however, and the greater part of his fleet was engaged in ferrying men across Blackwater Bay for the assault on that island stronghold. The remainder prowled Shipbreaker Bay to the south, where only their presence prevented Storm's End from being resupplied by sea. Arrain Waters bristled at Sir Loras's suggestion. "If Lord Redwine sails his ships away, how are we to supply our men on Dragonstone? Without the Arbor's galleys, how will we maintain the siege of Storm's End?"
"The siege can be resumed later, after—"
Circe cut him off.
"Storm's End is 100 times more valuable than the shields, and Dragonstone, so long as Dragonstone remains in the hands of Stannis Baratheon, it is a knife at my son's throat. We will release Lord Redwine and his fleet when the castle falls."
The Queen pushed herself to her feet. "This audience is at an end. Grand Maester Pycelle, a word." The old man started as if her voice had woken him from some dream of youth, but before he could answer, Loras Tyrell strode forward so swiftly that the Queen drew back in alarm. She was about to shout for Sir Osmond to defend her when the Knight of Flowers sank to one knee.
"Your Grace, let me take Dragonstone."
Her sister's hand went to her mouth.
"Loras, no."
Sir Loras ignored her plea. "It will take 1/2 year or more to starve Dragonstone into submission, as Lord Paxter means to do. Give me the command, Your Grace. The castle will be yours within 1 fortnight if I have to tear it down with my bare hands." No one had given Circe such a lovely gift since Sansa Stark had run to her to divulge Lord Eddard's plans. She was pleased to see that Marjorie had gone pale.
"Your courage takes my breath away, Sir Loras,"
Circe said. "Lord Waters, are any of the new Drummonds fit to put to sea?"
"Sweet Circe is, Your Grace, a swift ship, and as strong as the Queen she's named for."
"Splendid! Let sweet Circe carry our Knight of Flowers to Dragonstone at once. Sir Loras, the command is yours. Swear to me that you shall not return until Dragonstone is Tommen's."
"I shall, Your Grace."
He rose. Circe kissed him on both cheeks. She kissed his sister, too, and whispered,
"You have a gallant brother."
Either Marjorie did not have the grace to answer, or fear had stolen all her words. Dawn was still several hours away when Circe slipped out the king's door behind the Iron Throne.
Sir Osmond went before her with a torch, and Caiban strolled along beside her. Pycelle had to struggle to keep up.
"If it please your grace," he puffed, "young men are overbold, and think only of the glory of battle, and never of its dangers. Sir Loras, this plan of his is fraught with peril. To storm the very walls of Dragonstone is very brave. Brave, yes, but
I have no doubt that our Knight of Flowers will be the first man to gain the battlements, and perhaps the first to fall. The pox-scarred bastard that Stannis had left to hold his castle was no callow, tawny champion, but a seasoned killer. If the gods were good, he would give Sir Loras the glorious end he seemed to want, assuming the boy does not drown on the way. There had been another storm last night, a savage one. The rain had come down in black sheets for hours. And wouldn't that be sad? The queen mused. Drowning is ordinary. Sir Loras lusts for glory as real men lust for women. The least the gods can do is grant him a death worthy of a song. No matter what befell the boy on Dragonstone, however, the queen would be the winner. If Loras took the castle, Stannis would suffer a grievous blow, and the Red Wine fleet could sail off to meet the Iron Men. If he failed, she would see to it that he had the lion's share of the blame. Nothing tarnishes a hero as much as failure. And if he should come home on his shield, covered in blood and glory, Sir Osney will be there to console his grieving sister. The laugh would not be contained any longer. It burst from Circe's lips and echoed down the hall.
"Your Grace," Grand Maester Pycelle blinked, his mouth sagging open. Why would you laugh?
Why, she had to say, elsewise I might weep. My heart is bursting with love for our Sir Loras and his valor. She left the Grand Maester on the Serpentine Steps. That one has outlived any usefulness he ever had, the Queen decided. All Pycelle ever seemed to do of late was plague her with cautions and objections. He had even objected to the understanding she had reached with the High Septon, gaping at her with dim and rheumy eyes when she commanded him to prepare the necessary papers, and babbling about old dead history until Circe cut him off. "King Maegor's day is done, and so are his decrees," she said firmly. "This is King Tommen's day, and mine. I would have done better to let him perish in the black cells." "Should Sir Loras fall, Your Grace will need to find another worthy for the King's Guard," Lord Caiban said as they crossed over the spiked moat that girded Maegor's holdfast.
"Someone splendid," she agreed.
"Someone so young and swift and strong that Tommen will forget all about Sir Loras. A bit of gallantry would not be amiss, but his head should not be full of foolish notions. Do you know of such a man?"
"Alas, no," said Caiban. "I had another sort of champion in mind. What he lacks in gallantry, he will give you tenfold in devotion. He will protect your son, kill your enemies, and keep your secrets, and no living man will be able to withstand him."
"So you say. Words are wind. When the hour is ripe, you may produce this paragon of yours, and we will see if he is all that you have promised."
"They will sing of him, I swear it."
Lord Caiban's eyes crinkled with amusement. "Might I ask about the armor?"
"I have placed your order. The armorer thinks that I am mad. He assures me that no man is strong enough to move and fight in such a weight of plate."
Circe gave the chainless maester a warning look. "Play me for a fool, and you'll die screaming. You are aware of that, I trust."
"Always, Your Grace."
"Good. Say no more of this.
The queen is wise. These walls have ears."
"So they do. At night, Circe sometimes heard soft sounds, even in her own apartments. Mice in the walls, she would tell herself, no more than that." A candle was burning by her bedside, but the hearth fire had gone out and there was no other light. The room was cold as well. Circe undressed and slipped beneath the blankets, leaving her gown to puddle on the floor. Across the bed, Taena stirred.
"Your Grace," she murmured softly, "what hour is it?"
"The hour of the owl," the queen replied.
Though Circe often slept alone, she had never liked it. Her oldest memories were of sharing a bed with Jaime when they had still been so young that no one could tell the two of them apart. Later, after they were separated, she'd had a string of bedmaids and companions, most of them girls of an age with her, the daughters of her father's household knights and bannermen. None had pleased her, and few lasted very long. Little sneaks, the lot of them, vapid, weepy creatures, always telling tales and trying to worm their way between me and Jamie. Still, there had been nights deep within the black bowels of the rock when she had welcomed their warmth beside her. An empty bed was a cold bed. Here, most of all, there were chills in this room, and her wretched royal husband had died beneath this canopy. Robert Baratheon, the first of his name, may there never be a second. A dim, drunken brute of a man, let him weep in hell. Taina warmed the bed as well as Robert ever had, and never tried to force Circe's legs apart. Of late she had shared the queen's bed more often than Lord Merryweather's. Orton did not seem to mind, or if he did, he knew better than to say so. "I was concerned when I woke and found you gone," murmured Lady Merryweather, sitting up against the pillows, the coverlets tangled about her waist. "Is aught amiss?" "No," said Circe, "all is well. On the morrow Solaris will sail for Dragonstone to win the castle, loose the red wine fleet, and prove his manhood to us all." She told the Mirish woman all that had occurred beneath the shifting shadows of the Iron Throne. "Without her valiant brother, our little queen is next to naked. She has her guards, to be sure, but I have their captain here and there about the castle, a garrulous old man with a squirrel on his surcoat. Squirrels run from lions. He does not have it in him to defy the Iron Throne." "Marjorie has other swords about her," cautioned Lady Merryweather. "She has made many friends about the court, and she and her young cousins all have admirers." "A few suitors do not concern me," Circe said. "The army at Storm's End, however." "What do you mean to do, Your Grace?" "Why do you ask?" The question was a little too pointed for Circe's taste. "I do hope you are not thinking of sharing my idle musings with our poor little queen." "Never. I am not that girl, Sennel." Circe did not care to think about Sennel. She repaid my kindness with betrayal. Sansa Stark had done the same. So had Melara Heatherspoon and Fat Jane Farman when the three of them were girls. I would never have gone into that tent if not for them. I would never have allowed Maggie the Frog to taste my morrows in a drop of blood. I would be very sad if you ever betrayed my trust, Taina. I would have no choice but to give you to Lord Qyburn. But I know that I should weep. I will never give you cause to weep, Your Grace. If I do, say the word, and I will give myself to Qyburn. I want only to be close to you, to serve you however you require. And for this service, what reward will you expect? Nothing. It pleases me to please you. Taina rolled onto her side, her olive skin shining in the candlelight. Her breasts were larger than the queen's and tipped with huge nipples black as horn. She is younger than I am. Her breasts have not begun to sag. Circe wondered what it would feel like to kiss another woman. Not lightly on the cheek, as was common courtesy amongst ladies of high birth, but full upon the lips. Taina's lips were very full. She wondered what it would feel like to suckle on those breasts, to lay the Mirish woman on her back and push her legs apart, and use her as a man would use her, the way Robert would use her when the drink was in him, and she was unable to bring him off with hand or mouth. Those had been the worst nights, lying helpless underneath him as he took his pleasure, stinking of wine and grunting like a boar. Usually he rolled off and went to sleep as soon as it was done, and was snoring before his seed could dry upon her thighs. She was always sore afterward, raw between the legs, her breasts painful from the mauling he would give them. The only time he'd ever made her wet was on their wedding night. Robert had been handsome enough when they first married, tall and strong and powerful, but his hair was black and heavy, thick on his chest and coarse around his sex. "The wrong man came back from the Trident," the queen would sometimes think as he was ploughing her. In the first few years, when he mounted her more often, she would close her eyes and pretend that he was Rhaegar. She could not pretend that he was Jaime. He was too different, too unfamiliar. Even the smell of him was wrong. For Robert, those nights never happened. Come morning, he remembered nothing, or so he would have had her believe. Once, during the first year of their marriage, Circe had voiced her displeasure the next day. "You hurt me," she complained. He had the grace to look ashamed. "It was not me, my lady," he said in a sulky, sullen tone, like a child caught stealing apple cakes from the kitchen. "It was the wine. I drink too much wine." To wash down his admission, he reached for his horn of ale. As he raised it to his mouth, she smashed her own horn in his face so hard she chipped a tooth. Years later at a feast, she heard him telling a serving wench how he'd cracked the tooth in a melee. "Well, our marriage was a melee," she reflected, "so he did not lie." The rest had all been lies, though. He did remember what he did to her at night. She was convinced of that. She could see it in his eyes. He only pretended to forget. It was easier to do that than to face his shame. Deep down, Robert Baratheon was a coward. In time, the assaults did grow less frequent. During the first year, he took her at least once a fortnight. By the end, it was not even once a year. He never stopped completely, though. Sooner or later, there would always come a night when he would drink too much and want to claim his rights. What shamed him in the light of day gave him pleasure in the darkness.
"My queen," said Taina Merryweather, "you have a strange look in your eyes. Are you unwell?"
"I was just remembering." Her throat was dry.
"You are a good friend, Taina. I have not had a true friend in..."
Someone hammered at the door. Again? The urgency of the sound made her shiver. Have another 1,000 ships descended on us? She slipped into a bedrobe and went to see who it was. "Beg pardon for disturbing you, Your Grace," the guardsman said, "but Lady Stokeworth is below, begging audience."
"At this hour?" snapped Circe. "Has Felice lost her wits?
Tell her I have retired. Tell her that small folk on the shields are being slaughtered. Tell her that I have been awake for half the night. I will see her on the morrow." The guard hesitated.
"If it please Your Grace, she's not in a good way, if you take my meaning."
Circe frowned. She had assumed Felice was here to tell her that Bronn was dead.
"Very well. I shall need to dress.
Take her to my solar and have her wait." When Lady Merryweather made to rise and come with her, the queen demurred.
"No, stay.
One of us should get some rest at least. I shan't be long." Lady Felice's face was bruised and swollen, her eyes red from her tears. Her lower lip was broken, her clothing soiled and torn.
"Gods be good,"
Circe said, as she ushered her into the solar and closed the door.
"What has happened to your face?"
Felice did not seem to hear the question.
"He killed him," she said in a quavery voice. "Mother have mercy, he...
She broke down sobbing, her whole body trembling. Circe poured a cup of wine and took it to the weeping woman.
"Drink this. The wine will calm you. That's it. A little more now. Stop that weeping and tell me why you're here."
It took the rest of the flagon before the queen was finally able to coax the whole sad tale out of Lady Felice. Once she had, she did not know whether to laugh or rage.
"Single combat," she repeated. "Is there no one in the Seven Kingdoms that I can rely upon? Am I the only one in Westeros with a pinch of wits?
You are telling me Sir Balmain challenged Bronn to single combat?
He said it would be simple. The lance is a knight's weapon, he said, and Bronn was no true knight. Balmain said he would unhorse him and finish him as he lay stunned."
Bronn was no knight, that was true. Bronn was a battle-hardened killer.
Your cretin of a husband wrote his own death warrant.
A splendid plan. Dare I ask how it went awry?
Bronn drove his lance through the chest of Balmain's poor horse. Balmain, his legs were crushed when the beast fell. He screamed so piteously.
Sellswords have no pity, Circe might have said. I asked you to arrange a hunting mishap, an arrow gone astray, a fall from a horse, an angry boar. There are so many ways a man can die in the woods, none of them involving lances. Felice did not seem to hear her.
When I tried to run to my Balmain, he struck me in the face.
He made my lord confess. Balmain was crying out for Maester Frenken to attend him, but the sellsword, he...
Confess? Circe did not like that word. I trust our brave Sir Balmain held his tongue.
Bronn put a dagger in his eye and told me I had best be gone from Stokeworth before the sun went down, or I'd get the same. He said he'd pass me around to the garrison, if any of them would have me. When I ordered Bronn seized, one of his knights had the insolence to say that I should do as Lord Stokeworth said. He called him Lord Stokeworth.
Lady Felice clutched at the Queen's hand.
Your Grace must give me knights, 100 knights, and crossbowmen to take my castle back. Stokeworth is mine. They would not even permit me to gather up my clothes.
Bronn said they were his wife's clothes now, all my silks and velvets. Your rags are the least of your concerns. The Queen pulled her fingers free of the other woman's clammy grasp. I asked you to snuff out a candle to help protect the king. Instead, you heaved a pot of wildfire at it. Did your witless Balmain bring my name into this? Tell me he did not. Felice licked her lips.
He was in pain. His legs were broken. Bronn said he would show him mercy, but what will happen to my poor mother?
I imagine she will die. What do you think? Lady Tanda might well be dead already. Bronn did not seem the sort of man who would expend much effort nursing an old woman with a broken hip.
You have to help me. Where am I to go? What will I do?
Perhaps you might wed Moon Boy, Circe almost said. He is nigh as big a fool as your late husband. She could not risk a war on the very doorstep of King's Landing, not now.
The Silent Sisters are always glad to welcome widows, she said. Theirs is a serene life, a life of prayer and contemplation and good works. They bring solace to the living and peace to the dead.
And they do not talk. She could not have the woman running about the Seven Kingdoms spreading dangerous tales. Felice was deaf to good sense.
All we did in service to your grace, proud to be faithful. You said,
I recall. Circe forced a smile. You shall stay here with us, my lady, until such time as we find a way to win your castle back. Let me pour you another cup of wine. It will help you sleep. You are weary and sick of heart, that's plain to see. My poor dear Felice. That's it. Drink up. As her guest was working on the flagon, Circe went to the door and called her maids. She told Dorcas to find Lord Caiban for her and bring him here at once. Jocelyn Swift she dispatched to the kitchens. Bring bread and cheese, a meat pie and some apples, and wine. We have a thirst. Caiban arrived before the food. Lady Felice had put down 3 more cups by then and was beginning to nod, though from time to time she would rouse and give another sob. The Queen took Caiban aside and told him of Sir Balmain's folly. I cannot have Felice spreading tales about the city. Her grief has made her witless. Do you still need women for your work?
I do, Your Grace. The puppeteers are quite used up.
Take her, and do with her as you will, then. But once she goes down into the black cells, need I say more?
No, Your Grace. I understand.
Good. The Queen donned her smile once again. Sweet Felice, Maester Kyburn's here. He'll help you rest.
Oh, said Felice vaguely. Oh, good.
When the door closed behind them, Circe poured herself another cup of wine. I am surrounded by enemies and imbeciles, she said. She could not even trust her own blood and kin, nor Jamie, who had once been her other half. He was meant to be my sword and shield, my strong right arm. Why does he insist on vexing me? Bronn was no more than an annoyance, to be sure. She had never truly believed that he was harboring the imp. Her twisted little brother was too clever to allow Lollies to name her wretched ill-begotten bastard after him, knowing it was sure to draw the Queen's wrath down upon her. Lady Merryweather had pointed that out, and she was right. The mockery was almost certainly the sellsword's doing. She could picture him watching his wrinkled red stepson sucking on one of Lolly's swollen dugs, a cup of wine in his hand and an insolent smile on his face.
Grin all you wish, Sir Bronn. You'll be screaming soon enough. Enjoy your lackwit lady and your stolen castle while you can. When the time comes, I shall swat you as if you were a fly. Perhaps you would send Loras Tyrell to do the swatting, if the Knight of Flowers should somehow return alive from Dragonstone. That would be delicious. If the gods were good, each of them would kill the other, like Sir Arik and Sir Eric. As for Stokeworth, no, she was sick of thinking about Stokeworth. Tena had drifted back to sleep by the time the queen returned to the bedchamber, her head spinning. Too much wine and too little sleep, she told herself. It was not every night that she was awakened twice with such desperate tidings. At least I could awaken. Robert would have been too drunk to rise, let her own rule. It would have fallen to John Arryn to deal with all of this. It pleased her to think that she made a better king than Robert. The sky outside the window was already beginning to lighten. Circe sat on the bed beside Lady Merryweather, listening to her soft breathing, watching her breasts rise and fall. Does she dream of Mir? She wondered. Or is it her lover with the scar, the dangerous dark-haired man who would not be refused? She was quite certain Tena was not dreaming of Lord Orton. Circe cupped the other woman's breast, softly at first, hardly touching, feeling the warmth of it beneath her palm, the skin as smooth as satin. She gave it a gentle squeeze, then ran her thumbnail lightly across the big dark nipple, back and forth and back and forth until she felt it stiffen. When she glanced up, Tana's eyes were open. "Does that feel good?" she asked. "Yes," said Lady Merryweather. "And this?" Circe pinched the nipple now, pulling on it hard, twisting it between her fingers. The Mirish woman gave a gasp of pain. "You're hurting me." "It's just the wine. I had a flagon with my supper and another with the widow Stokeworth. I had to drink to keep her calm." She twisted Tana's other nipple too, pulling until the other woman gasped. "I am the queen. I mean to claim my rights. Do what you will." Tana's hair was black as Robert's, even down between her legs, and when Circe touched her there, she found her hair all sopping wet, where Robert's had been coarse and dry. "Please," the Mirish woman said, "go on, my queen. Do as you will with me. I'm yours." But it was no good. She could not feel it, whatever Robert felt on the nights he took her. There was no pleasure in it, not for her. For Tena, yes. Her nipples were two black diamonds, her sex slick and steamy. Robert would have loved you for an hour. The queen slid a finger into that Mirish swamp, then another, moving them in and out. But once he spent himself inside you, he would have been hard-pressed to recall your name. She wanted to see if it would be as easy with a woman as it had always been with Robert. 10,000 of your children perished in my palm, Your Grace, she thought, slipping a third finger into Mir. Whilst you snored, I would lick your sons off my face and fingers one by one, all those pale, sticky princes. You claimed your rights, my lord, but in the darkness I would eat your heirs. Tena gave a shudder. She gasped some words in a foreign tongue, then shuddered again and arched her back and screamed. She sounds as if she is being gored, the queen thought. For a moment she let herself imagine that her fingers were a boar's tusks, ripping the Mirish woman apart from groin to throat. It was still no good. It had never been any good with anyone but Jamie. When she tried to take her hand away, Tena caught it and kissed her fingers. "Sweet queen, how shall I pleasure you?" She slid her hand down Circe's side and touched her sex. "Tell me what you would have of me, my love." "Leave me." Circe rolled away and pulled up the bedclothes to cover herself, shivering. Dawn was breaking. It would soon be morning and all of this would be forgotten. It had never happened.
Reek. He heard the girls first, barking as they raced for home. The drum of hoofbeats, echoing off flagstone, jerked him to his feet, chains rattling. The one between his ankles was no more than a foot long, shortening his stride to a shuffle. It was hard to move quickly that way, but he tried as best he could, hopping and clanking from his pallet. Ramsay Bolton had returned, and would want his reek on hand to serve him. Outside, beneath a cold autumnal sky, the hunters were pouring through the gates. Ben Bones led the way, with the girls baying and barking all around him. Behind came Skinner, Sir Alan, and Damon Dance for Me, with his long, greased whip. Then the Walders riding the grey colts Lady Dustin had given them. His lordship himself rode Blood, a red stallion with a temper to match his own. He was laughing. That could be very good or very bad, Reek knew. The dogs were on him before he could puzzle out which, drawn to his scent. The dogs were fond of Reek. He slept with them oft as not, and sometimes Ben Bones let him share their supper. The pack raced across the flagstones, barking, circling him, jumping up to lick his filthy face, nipping at his legs. Hellicent caught his left hand between her teeth, and worried it so fiercely, Reek feared he might lose two more fingers. Red Jane slammed into his chest and knocked him off his feet. She was lean, hard muscle, where Reek was loose grey skin and brittle bones, a white-haired starveling. The riders were dismounting by the time he pushed Red Jane off and struggled to his knees. Two dozen horsemen had gone out, and two dozen had returned, which meant the search had been a failure. That was bad. Ramsay did not like the taste of failure. "He will want to hurt someone." Of late, his lord had been forced to restrain himself, for Barrington was full of men House Bolton needed, and Ramsay knew to be careful around the Dustins and Riswells and his fellow lordlings. With them he was always courteous and smiling. What he was behind closed doors was something else. Ramsay Bolton was attired as befit the Lord of the Hornwood, an heir to the Dreadfort. His mantle was stitched together from wolfskins and clasped against the autumn chill by the yellow teeth of a wolf's head on his right shoulder. On one hip he wore a falchion, its blade as thick and heavy as a cleaver. On the other, a long dagger and a small curved flaying knife with a hooked point and a razor-sharp edge. All three blades had matched hilts of yellow bone. "Reek," his lordship called down from Blood's high saddle. "You stink. I can smell you clear across the yard." "I know, my lord," Reek had to say. "I beg your pardon." "I brought you a gift." Ramsay twisted, reached behind him, pulled something from his saddle, and flung it. "Catch!" Between the chain, the fetters, and his missing fingers, Reek was clumsier than he had been before he learned his name. The head struck his maimed hands, bounced away from the stumps of his fingers, and landed at his feet, raining maggots. It was so crusted with dried blood as to be unrecognizable. "I told you to catch it," said Ramsay. "Pick it up." Reek tried to lift the head up by the ear. It was no good. The flesh was green and rotting, and the ear tore off between his fingers. Little Walder laughed, and a moment later the other men were laughing too. "Oh, leave him be," said Ramsay. "Just see to Blood. I rode the bastard hard." "Yes, my lord, I will." Reek hurried to the horse, leaving the severed head for the dogs. "You smell like pig shit today, Reek," said Ramsay. "On him, that's an improvement," said Damon Dance for Me, smiling as he coiled his whip. Little Walder swung down from the saddle. "You can see to my horse too, Reek, and to my little cousins." "I can see to my own horse," said Big Walder. Little Walder had become Lord Ramsay's best boy, and grew more like him every day. But the smaller Frey was made of different stuff, and seldom took part in his cousin's games and cruelties. Reek paid the squires no mind. He led Blood off toward the stables, hopping aside when the stallion tried to kick him. The hunters strode into the hall, all but Ben Bones, who was cursing at the dogs to stop them fighting over the severed head. Big Walder followed him into the stables, leading his own mount. Reek stole a look at him as he removed Blood's bit. "Who was he?" he said softly, so the other stable hands would not hear. "No one." Big Walder pulled the saddle off his grey. "An old man we met on the road, is all. He was driving an old nanny goat and four kids.
His lordship slew him for his goats."
"His lordship slew him for calling him Lord Snow. The goats were good, though. We milked the mother and roasted up the kids."
"Lord Snow?"
Reek nodded, his chains clinking as he wrestled with Blood's saddle straps.
"By any name, Ramsay's no man to be around when he's in a rage, or when he's not.
Did you find your cousins, my lord?"
"No, I never thought we would. They're dead. Lord Wyman had them killed. That's what I would have done if I were him." Reek said nothing. Some things were not safe to say, not even in the stables with his lordship in the hall. One wrong word could cost him another toe, even a finger.
"Not my tongue, though. He will never take my tongue. He likes to hear me plead with him to spare me from the pain. He likes to make me say it."
The riders had been 16 days on the hunt, with only hard bread and salt beef to eat, aside from the occasional stolen kid. So that night Lord Ramsay commanded that a feast be laid to celebrate his return to Barrington. Their host, a grizzled one-armed petty lord by the name of Harwood Stout, knew better than to refuse him, though by now his larders must be well-nigh exhausted. Reek had heard Stout servants muttering at how the bastard and his men were eating through the winter stores.
"He'll bed Lord Eddard's little girl, they say," Stout's cook complained, when she did not know that Reek was listening. "But we're the ones who'll be fucked when the snows come, you mark my words."
Yet Lord Ramsay had decreed a feast, so feast they must. Trestle tables were set up in Stout's hall. An ox was slaughtered, and that night as the sun went down, the empty-handed hunters ate roasts and ribs, barley bread, a mash of carrots and peas, washing it all down with prodigious quantities of ale. It fell to Little Walder to keep Lord Ramsay's cup filled, whilst Big Walder poured for the others at the high table. Reek was chained up beside the doors, lest his odour put the feasters off their appetites. He would eat later off whatever scraps Lord Ramsay thought to send him. The dogs enjoyed the run of the hall, however, and provided the night's best entertainment. When Maud and Grey Jane tore into one of Lord Stout's hounds over an especially meaty bone that Will Short had tossed them, Reek was the only man in the hall who did not watch the three dogs fight. He kept his eyes on Ramsay Bolton. The fight did not end until their host's dog was dead. Stout's old hound never stood a mummer's chance. He had been 1 against 2, and Ramsay's bitches were young, strong, and savage. Ben Bones, who liked the dogs better than their master, had told Reek they were all named after peasant girls Ramsay had hunted, raped, and killed back when he'd still been a bastard, running with the first Reek.
"The ones who give him good sport, anyways. The ones who weep and beg and won't run, don't get to come back as bitches."
The next litter to come out of the Dreadfort's kennels would include a Kyra, Reek did not doubt.
"He's trained them to kill wolves as well,"
Ben Bones had confided. Reek said nothing. He knew which wolves the girls were meant to kill, but he had no wish to watch the girls fighting over his severed toe. 2 serving men were carrying off the dead dog's carcass, and an old woman had fetched out a mop and rake and bucket to deal with the blood-soaked rushes, when the doors to the hall flew open in a wash of wind, and 12 men in grey mail and iron half-helms stalked through, shouldering past Stout's pasty-faced young guards in their leather brigandines and cloaks of gold and russet. A sudden silence seized the feasters, all but Lord Ramsay, who tossed aside the bone he had been gnawing, wiped his mouth on his sleeve, smiled a greasy, wet-lipped smile, and said, "Father!" The Lord of the Dreadfort glanced idly at the remnants of the feast, at the dead dog, at the hangings on the walls, at Reek in his chains and fetters. "Out," he told the feasters, in a voice as soft as a murmur. "Now, the lot of you." Lord Ramsay's men pushed back from the tables, abandoning cups and trenchers. Ben Bones shouted at the girls, and they trotted after him, some with bones still in their jaws. Harwood Stout bowed stiffly and relinquished his haul without a word. "Unchain Reek and take him with you," Ramsay growled at Sir Alan. But his father waved a pale hand and said, "No, leave him." Even Lord Roos's own guards retreated, pulling the doors shut behind them. When the echo died away, Reek found himself alone in the hall with the two Boltons, father and son. "You did not find our missing phrase." The way Roose Bolton said it, it was more a statement than a question. "We rode back to where Lord Lamprey claims they parted ways, but the girls could not find a trail. You asked after them in villages and holdfasts. A waste of words. The peasants might as well be blind for all they ever see." Ramsay shrugged. "Does it matter? The world won't miss a few phrases. There's plenty more down at the Twins, should we ever have need of one." Lord Roos tore a small piece off a heel of bread and ate it. "Hustine and Aeneas are distressed. Let them go looking if they like. Lord Wyman blames himself. To hear him tell it, he had become especially fond of Rhaegar." Lord Ramsay was turning wroth. Reek could see it in his mouth, the curl of those thick lips, the way the cord stood out in his neck. "The fools should have stayed with Manderley." Roos Bolton shrugged. "Lord Wyman's litter moves at a snail's pace, and of course his lordship's health and girth do not permit him to travel more than a few hours a day, with frequent stops for meals. The Freys were anxious to reach Barrington and be reunited with their kin. Can you blame them for riding on ahead?" "If that's what they did. Do you believe, Manderley?" His father's pale eyes glittered. "Did I give you that impression? Still, his lordship is most distraught. Not so distraught that he can't eat. Lord Pig must have brought half the food in White Harbour with him. 40 wains full of foodstuffs, casks of wine and hippocras, barrels of fresh-caught lampreys, a herd of goats, 100 pigs, crates of crabs and oysters, a monstrous codfish Lord Wyman likes to eat. You may have noticed." "What I noticed was that he brought no hostages. I noticed that as well. What do you mean to do about it?" "It is a quandary." Lord Roos found an empty cup, wiped it out on the tablecloth, and filled it from a flagon. "Manderley is not alone in throwing feasts, it would seem. It should have been you who threw the feast to welcome me back," Ramsay complained. "And it should have been in Barrow Hall, not this piss-pot of a castle. Barrow Hall and its kitchens are not mine to dispose of," his father said mildly. "I am only a guest there. The castle and the town belong to Lady Dustin, and she cannot abide you." Ramsay's face darkened. "If I cut off her teats and feed them to my girls, will she abide me then? Will she abide me if I strip off her skin to make myself a pair of boots? Unlikely, and those boots would come dear. They would cost us Barrington, House Dustin, and the Risewells." Roos Bolton seated himself across the table from his son. "Barbary Dustin is my second wife's younger sister, Roderick Risewell's daughter, sister to Roger, Rickard, and mine own namesake Roos, cousin to the other Risewells. She was fond of my late son, and suspects you of having some part in his demise.
Lady Barbary is a woman who knows how to nurse a grievance. Be grateful for that. Berriton is staunch for Bolton, largely because she still holds Ned Stark to blame for her husband's death. Staunch? Ramsay seized. All she does is spit on me. The day will come when I'll set her precious wooden town afire. Let her spit on that. See if it puts out the flames. Roos made a face, as if the ale he was sipping had suddenly gone sour. There are times you make me wonder if you truly are my seed. My forebears were many things, but never fools. No, be quiet now. I've heard enough. We appear strong for the moment, yes. We have powerful friends in the Lannisters and Freys, and the grudging support of much of the North. But what do you imagine is going to happen when one of Ned Stark's sons turns up?
Ned Stark's sons are all dead, Reek thought. Rob was murdered at the Twins, and Bran and Rickon. We dipped their heads in tar.
His own head was pounding. He did not want to think about anything that had happened before he knew his name. There were things too hurtful to remember, thoughts almost as painful as Ramsay's flaying knife. Stark's little wolflings are dead, said Ramsay, slushing some more ale into his cup. And they'll stay dead. Let them show their ugly faces, and my girls will rip those wolves of theirs to pieces. The sooner they turn up, the sooner I kill them again. The elder Bolton sighed. Again? Oh, surely you misspeak. You never slew Lord Eddard's sons, those two sweet boys we love so well. That was Theon Turncloak's work, remember? How many of our grudging friends do you imagine we'd retain if the truth were known? Only Lady Barbary, whom you would turn into a pair of boots, inferior boots. Human skin is not as tough as cowhide, and will not wear as well. By the king's decree, you are now a Bolton. Try and act like one. Tales are told of you, Ramsay. I hear them everywhere. People fear you. Good. You are mistaken. It is not good. No tales were ever told of me. Do you think I would be sitting here if it were otherwise? Your amusements are your own. I will not chide you on that count. But you must be more discreet. A peaceful land, a quiet people, that has always been my rule. Make it yours. Is this why you left Lady Dustin and your fat pig wife? So you could come down here and tell me to be quiet? Not at all. These are tidings that you need to hear. Lord Stannis has finally left the wall. That got Ramsay halfway to his feet, a smile glistening on his wide, wet lips. Is he marching on the Dreadnought? He is not, alas. Arnulf does not understand it. He swears that he did all he could to bait the trap. I wonder. Scratch a Karstark, and you'll find a Stark. After the scratch the young wolf gave Lord Rickard, that may be somewhat less true than formerly. Be that as it may, Lord Stannis has taken Deepwood Mott from the Iron Men and restored it to House Glover. Worse, the Mountain Clans have joined him, Wald and Norre and Liddell and the rest. His strength is growing. Ours is greater. Now it is. Now is the time to smash him. Let me march on Deepwood. After you are wed. Ramsay slammed down his cup, and the dregs of his ale erupted across the tablecloth. I'm sick of waiting. We have a girl, we have a tree, and we have lords enough to witness. I'll wed her on the morrow, plant a sun between her legs, and march before her maiden's blood has dried.
She'll pray for you to march, Reek thought, and she'll pray that you never come back to her bed.
You will plant a son in her, Roose Bolton said, but not here. I've decided you shall wed the girl at Winterfell. That prospect did not appear to please Lord Ramsay. I laid waste to Winterfell, or had you forgotten? No, but it appears you have. The Iron Men
laid waste to Winterfell, and butchered all its people, Theon Turncloak. Ramsay gave Reek a suspicious glance. Aye, so he did. But still, a wedding in that ruin? Even ruined and broken, Winterfell remains Lady Arya's home. What better place to wed her, bed her, and stake your claim? That is only half of it, however. We would be fools to march on Stannis. Let Stannis march on us. He is too cautious to come to Barrowton, but he must come to Winterfell. His clansmen will not abandon the daughter of their precious Ned to such as you. Stannis must march or lose them. And being the careful commander that he is, he will summon all his friends and allies when he marches. He will summon Arnulf Karstark. Ramsay licked his chapped lips. And we'll have him. If the gods will it. Roose rose to his feet. You'll wed at Winterfell. I shall inform the lords that we march in 3 days and invite them to accompany us. You are the warden of the north. Command them. An invitation will accomplish the same thing. Power tastes best when sweetened by courtesy. You had best learn that if you ever hope to rule. The Lord of the Dreadfort glanced at Reek. Oh, and unchain your pet. I'm taking him. Taking him? Where? He's mine. You cannot have him. Roos seemed amused by that. All you have I gave you. You would do well to remember that, bastard. As for this Reek, if you have not ruined him beyond redemption, he may yet be of some use to us. Get the keys and remove those chains from him. Before you make me rue the day I raped your mother. Reek saw the way Ramsay's mouth twisted, the spittle glistening between his lips. He feared he might leap the table with his dagger in his hand. Instead, he flushed red, turned his pale eyes from his father's paler ones, and went to find the keys. But as he knelt to unlock the fetters around Reek's wrist and ankles, he leaned close and whispered, "Tell him nothing, and remember every word he says. I'll have you back, no matter what that Dustin bitch may tell you. Who are you?"
"Reek, my lord, your man. I'm Reek. It rhymes with sneak."
"It does. When my father brings you back, I'm going to take another finger. I'll let you choose which one."
Unbidden, tears began to trickle down his cheeks.
"Why?" he cried, his voice breaking. "I never asked for him to take me from you. I'll do whatever you want. Serve, obey. Please, no."
Ramsay slapped his face. "Take him," he told his father. "He's not even a man. The way he smells disgusts me."
The moon was rising over the wooden walls of Barrowton when they stepped outside. Reek could hear the wind sweeping across the rolling plains beyond the town. It was less than a mile from Barrow Hall to Hardwood Start's modest keep beside the eastern gates. Lord Bolton offered him a horse.
"Can you ride?"
My lord, I think so."
"Walton, help him up." Even with the fetters gone, Reek moved like an old man. His flesh hung loosely on his bones, and Sir Alan and Ben Bones said he twitched. And his smell! Even the mare they'd bought for him shied away when he tried to mount. She was a gentle horse, though, and she knew the way to Barrow Hall. Lord Bolton fell in beside him as they rode out the gate. The guards fell back to a discreet distance. "What would you have me call you?" the lord asked, as they trotted down the broad, straight streets of Barrowton.
"Reek, I'm Reek. It rhymes with Reek." "Reek," he said, "if it please my lord."
"My lord," Bolton's lips parted just enough to show a quarter inch of teeth. It might have been a smile. He did not understand.
"My lord," I said.
"My lord, when you should have said my lord. Your tongue betrays your birth with every word you say.
if you want to sound a proper peasant, say it as if you had mud in your mouth, or were too stupid to realise it was two words, not just one.
If that please, my lord.
Better. Your stench is quite appalling.
Yes, my lord. I beg your pardon, my lord.